Well, the first thing to say, I suppose, is that a lot of people won't realise the impact that the bow has on the sound. I could make two very similar bows from very similar wood, and they'll each produce a different result on the instrument. And the explanation for that, I suppose, is that when you play something like a violin, you've got a system where every part of the instrument is vibrating, and there's vibrations running up and down the stick, so the entire stick is vibrating. And if you change the material even slightly, you get a different sound as a result. So there's a lot of scope there then to arrive at a sound that somebody wants. So if somebody wants a dark sound, I'll look through the sticks that I have and I'll select something that I think will produce that kind of sound. Let's grab a complete bow there and I can explain it better that way. So there we go. There's a complete bow that I made some time ago. The main component, the vital component, is the stick, made of Pernambuco from Brazil. The stick dictates, the stick and how it's treated by the maker dictates how the bow is going to sound, how it's going to feel, how useful or not it's going to be for the player. So the stick is everything. And then at the end of the stick, you have this thing called the frog, which is really a mechanism for holding the hair at a certain height away from the stick and allows tension to be put on the hair so that the bow can be tightened up for playing and detensioned while it's not being played. In theory, it's a simple mechanism, but it's made relatively ornate. So the frog is a thing that in itself hopefully looks aesthetically pleasing, that conceals a very practical function. And the button the same, the mechanism for pulling the frog along the stick. That's a nice looking thing in itself, but it could just as easily be a lump of wood. Until we unscrew it here. The button starts off as a round piece of ebony with two round bands of silver fitted onto it, and then the whole thing shaped together to give you an eight-sided thing about 8.5 millimetres in diameter with some round collars cut on the lathe on the front, again for aesthetic effect primarily. And then there's a screw inserted into that button which goes into the stick, connects with the frog inside the stick and allows you to pull that frog back along the stick when you turn the button. So it's quite a simple thing. Simple but effective. Well, I'd call this part of it the stick. Yeah, anything that isn't the hair of the frog or the button is the stick. That'll arrive to me in planks like that. So you see planks here, a couple of inches wide, a metre or so long, half an inch thick, and I cut that into a stick that very roughly resembles a simple bow shape, and then I work from there with planes, knives and files to get it to what you see there in the finished bow. The curve of the stick is an absolutely vital part of how that bow will work. Absolutely critical. How that curve is shaped, combined with the dimensions of the stick, will determine how well that bow will play or not play, as the case may be. One of the fantastic things about this wood, one of the reasons why it's so ideal, is that you can heat it up, put a curve into it, and it'll hold that shape for a long, long time. And even if it twists or bends, loses a bit of curve, anything like that, all that stuff can be addressed. You can heat up any area that's bent, and you can straighten it. If it twists along its length, you can heat it up and take the twist out. You can endlessly restore that curve, or the camber, as we call it. Some people like a really flexible stick. Some people like a very strong stick. A bow is a very, very personal thing. And what people want differs hugely from one person to another.
Hi, Gary. good to see you.
How are you?
I bought you a bow with no hair.
Right, okay. I was laughing seeing those hairs breaking last night.
God, that was crazy, wasn't it? Let me give you this. There. And I must get the other one back from you.
Yes, sure.
I'm Catherine Hunker. I play chamber music and do solo stuff. And then I have the Far-Flung Trio with accordion, bass and me, and we play anything, really. I started playing when I was 4, which is, for the fiddle, I think that's probably quite a good age to start. You need to start playing before you're already conscious of what you're doing, because it's not a very natural instrument. This thing stuck underneath your chin. So it's great when kids start before they really have the chance to notice that it's quite awkward. So this is a Jean-Baptiste Viom fiddle, and I think it's 1872 it was made. Initially, I had a Voirin bow, and Voirin and Viom were mates. I would have thought that that would just be the perfect match, you know, and it turned out not to be the case at all. I came to Westport 2 years ago to play in the Chamber Music Festival here, and I came to visit Gary and tried one of his bows, and it was a far better match for my instrument. And so I think that the conversation between violin and bow, that you don't know if it's going to work or not, basically. There's not a science to that. It's just like two people. So the Irish Mayo bow, Gary Leahy's bow, chatted very well to the Parisian fiddle. Got on like a house on fire. So I bought two of Gary's bows. But they're two very, very different ones. They play very differently, and so then I can just pick and choose which of those I use. So this is the one I played last night. I call the octagon. I call it that because it I don't even know if it has eight surfaces, but it has these beautiful flat surfaces on the bow and quite light wood. It's quite a sunny kind of a one. It's quite a sunny bow. The stick dances. It's lovely if the wood moves. And this has a lot of movement in it. And then the other bow that I bought about a year later, I call it the dark and sultry bow because it's a bit heavier. It's darker in the wood. And I think it's a different sound. I'll play the same. So that's a deeper sound, a richer sound. And there'll be times when I'm just in a mood for that sound and times where I want to do something that is a bit more spinny. That's how I imagine it, that I'm making more spin and less whirr. So then it's entirely, I use up whichever bow I feel like of the two.
The Pernambuco I get from a supplier in America. It comes from the coast of Brazil, the Atlantic coast. There are four or five different related trees that all come under the title of Pernambuco. It's very hardwood. It's very dense. It'll generally sink in water. How it came into Europe initially used to be brought in as a red dye at a time, say in the 15 and 1600s, when red was a very difficult colour to produce. This wood gives you red. It's quite a strong dye. If you drop a few shavings of this stuff in a glass of water, it'll be pink in seconds. So when I'm working with this stuff, my hands are absolutely purple. Around the mid-1700s, somebody tried it. It was an experiment, probably, to see how it would work for bow making. By the end of the 1700s, it was the wood of choice, and nothing has been found since to come anywhere near it. Thank you.
I'm Eric Robichek. I supply Gary with Pernambuco and Ebony. Pernambuco, its common name is Pau Brazil. It's such a mundane-looking wood at first sight, but the heartwood is a glowing red-orange. The explorers who discovered it along the coastline of Brazil in the 1500s thought the tree looked like brasa, or burning embers. So it became known as brasawood, Brazilwood, and then it was the land of Brazil. And that's how Brazil got its name. The people back at the European ports just refer to it as the wood that's coming out of the Brazilian state of Pernambuco. So it got the lazy name of Pernambuco. Pernambuco grows really quickly. However, it's the old growth material that the bow makers need. That wood takes at least 40 years or more to get any wood that's decent for a violin bow. You need that elasticity, you need that strength, you need the density, and that comes with time. And also, the trees need to work hard. They need to grow in a place where they're getting the right nutrients, but they're also battling the elements.
Moving right along the stick out to the head of the bow, you can see on the base of the head, there is a white layer and a black layer. The black layer is ebony and the white layer is ivory. And that comes from the tusk of the woolly mammoth. You see a nice form there that conceals the function again. It looks well, it complements the head really well, but it also serves to bind the base of the head and just support it. If you didn't have anything on here, because the head is hollow inside, you could have the back of the head cracking or even breaking off. It's a tiny component of the bow, but it's very important. It's not as pure white as elephant ivory can be. It's not always easy to get it that white, and some people really like that bright whiteness. I don't worry about that. It's a little off-white. It's absolutely fine. It's a fantastic alternative. It comes cut into pieces, each piece being enough for one bow. So it's an L-shaped piece of tusk, glued onto the base of the head, and then is carved with the head, as if it were part of the head, which, of course, by then, it is. I get perfectly legal ivory from an interesting character, actually, who lives in Ohio.
My name is Chuck Leek, and I live in Fairbanks, Alaska. I've lived here for 36 years. I am an artist, a sculptor. I work with old ivory and bones and antlers, materials that are found in Alaska. Part of my career that helps fund my artwork is providing raw materials to other artists in the form of mammoth tusks, ivory, and bones. I always look for different materials to work with. And in the maybe late 80s, they banned all the trade in elephant ivory, and I saw an opportunity. Because at the time in Fairbanks, mammoth ivory was really common. I mean, the people had it in their yards, and they found it gold mining. And there's thousands of them buried in the permanently frozen ground around Fairbanks. And I started buying it. I had a few years there in the early 90s when the Japanese came over, and they were looking for a substitute for the honko that they use as their signature stamp. And so they bought many, many tons of mammoth ivory. And at that time, I made considerable sum of money, which I'd never had in my life, and it was quite enjoyable. I wish that would happen again sometime, but because it was so available, we bought it cheap and we got a really good price for it. But I knew that was going to come to an end, and they didn't really find it suitable. But then I developed a domestic market with the custom knife makers and jewelers. They like material that's highly mineralized and turns blue. It's usually found in deep layers of permafrost, and the rest of it is from rivers. We've got a lot of erosion with global warming. In Alaska, there's probably 10 to 15,000 pounds just wash out naturally from the banks and from gold mines. And I buy several thousand pounds a year to use in my artwork, but also to sell and use that to provide for my family. And one of my primary sources, a village that I don't really want to mention because I don't want everybody going there, but it's a village that has a great deal of erosion, and they find that when the ground underneath their houses is washing away, they go out and collect it after storms primarily. And then there's younger folks that go out in boats along the banks and find it. It's legally acquired on patented mining claims and on native land, and I'm really careful where it comes from. I don't buy from places that I think might be restricted. I sell to a gentleman in Ohio who processes the ivory into parts for musical instruments, and he supplies musical instrument makers around the world. The ivory that is permanently frozen, that was deposited soon after the animal died, is the kind of material that he looks for, and when we find it, I call him first, and it's the most expensive. It's just like solid as modern elephant ivory. You want something with integrity and something that's not going to delaminate, and that's the stuff that goes into musical instruments, the very best.
Classical players will want, and what traditional players will want, are pretty much the same thing, really. Most of the time, I could make a bow designed for a particular traditional player, but a lot of classical players would really like it, and vice versa. I don't do anything different apart from what people specifically want. I don't change anything, really. What happened to me was that I moved to New Zealand in 1996. And I ended up working at a violin shop there. And a guy who is an extraordinary violin maker offered to teach me how to repair and restore instruments. I was working as a tree surgeon at the time in New Zealand, actually. So I started learning some stuff from him in the evenings. Then a guy came along who wanted to open a shop. He hired this guy, John Hart, and myself. And I worked there for 5 years. Ended up doing a huge amount of the bow repair and bow rehairing work and bow restoration work. Got more and more interested in bows. And then I was back in Ireland for a visit 1 year, and I went to visit Noel Burke, the great bow maker, who was based in Westport at the time. It was the first time I'd seen a bow maker at work, and I was absolutely fascinated. And Noel offered to teach me how to make a bow. So I moved back from New Zealand a year later to take up that opportunity and see what it was like. And I just loved it. Noel was generous enough to let me work with him for 3 years. I became quite obsessed quite quickly and realized that that's what I wanted to put my time into. Oh, yes, the hair. Yeah, I nearly forgot about the hair. The hair is crucial, of course. It's mares, tails that make up this stuff. I suppose there's a certain amount of strength that's essential, and this has it. Nothing beats horsehair. It's amazing to think that, I don't know how far back the use of horsehair on bowed instruments goes. It's many, many, many centuries. And in all that time, nothing has been found that beats the simple tail of a horse. Amazing, isn't that? That's how I got it. Yeah, I'd buy it by the kilo. It's ostensibly a simple enough process of cutting off an appropriate amount of hair, tying the ends and fitting it into the bow. But it's a tricky thing to do, actually. It's a thing that takes ages to learn. It's just a slightly awkward job to get the hang of. Well, this piece that we spoke about earlier, the frog, comes apart. There's a silver ferrule on the front of it that comes away. There's a slide made of shell that comes out, and inside the frog is hollow. The hair goes in through a gap in the front, goes down into a mortise, and is held in there with a little wooden plug. And then at the other end, in the head of the bow, it's a very similar thing. The inside of the head is hollow in here. The hair goes down into a mortise, and it's held in place with another wooden plug. Very simple, but very secure. I'll buy it from a supplier in Yorkshire. They're an old company. There's a guy called Michael Sowden, and he has 2 sons, I think, that work in the company with him. And they would be absolutely flat out. Their sole occupation is bringing in this hair, dressing it and preparing it for people like me. They'd be very popular among bow makers. Pretty good quality hair. Great to deal with as well, you know. With a lot of suppliers, if I'm putting in an order, I'll email them. But with these guys, they're very cheery characters and they have these fantastic Yorkshire accents, so I ring them just to have a bit of a chat. It'd be a great place to visit, I'd say. It'd be interesting. I'd love to go, actually.
Ah, there he is.
Hey, how are you doing?
Hi, Gary. It's good to meet you.
Been a while, we finally met.
Yeah.
Well, we're here at Michael T. Sowden & Sons in the village of Driglinton. It's a small establishment, but we get to a fair bit of horse hair around the world. Follow me. Mind your step. So, this is my father, Michael Sr.
Hello, Michael.
Are you Gary?
How are you?
Hi, fine, Gary.
Good to meet you at last.
Yes, nice to see you.
It's great to see this place after having dealt with your hair for so long. It's great to finally meet you both.
I don't know what image you had in your mind, Gary, but,
I had no earrings, really.
Did you not?
I didn't know what to imagine.
Very rare I get visitors, to be honest, so it's nice to greet somebody and show them what we do, you know.
We're the only ones who take care of any hair that we get, you know, We sort of really take care of it.
The professional stuff, we start at 32-inch, which is 81 centimetre, and then it goes up in 1-inch increments. This has come from China, Mongolia, some southern Siberian areas. Really, there's very little difference between a mare's hair and a stallion's hair. The only difference is the coloration, because obviously the stallion will urinate underneath the body and away. But a mare's hair should be as strong. Some bow makers do want stallion hair, or they do want mare's hair, and they don't want the other. They're very particular what works for them. So it comes in a fairly reasonably dressed state, but we'll untie bundles and we'll hang them up under a certain light and we'll take out all the bad hairs. So I'll start at the bottom of the bundle while I'm sat on a seat. So the eye line is straight across. I will sift through that in small segments. You can feel a rough hair. You can feel it before you see it, and then you remove that. So I touch and feel every hair, and then I'll stand up and continue further up, twisting and turning the hair as I'm looking. Once I've done the root end, I will turn it around and repeat all the process. Roughly, there's around about 500 grams of hair there. It's going to take me around about 5 hours to make sure that any hair that doesn't belong in there has been taken out. And then you're left with around about 50% of the really good hair. And you know that you've done a day's work. It's a, you know, it can be tasking.
The frog is made of ebony. And ebony is extraordinary stuff. I find it staggering that a wood could grow absolutely jet black like that. Why would that be the case, you know? It gives you a beautiful finish, no open pores, easy to work with. There's a lot of carving involved, so the knife is very important. I'll use this gouge, these two large chisels, these two small chisels, and files. The outside of the branch is white. The outside of the tree is just a nondescript colour. It's not black, like. The sections of branch that I buy, you've got a white sapwood, and then that just stops, and all the heartwood is jet black. I wouldn't recognise an ebony tree. I've never seen one. I'd love to see one.
I source mine between Vietnam and Cambodia. I don't stay in the cities. I go into the jungles. I help my crew find the materials. I eat with them. We learn about each other. That's how you become part of the crew's family, and that's how you get close to some of the most incredible material. My brother had discovered back in the 90s the general area where some of this material was coming from, but it was a crapshoot whether or not the quality was there. He was getting about maybe 2-4% yield on entire trees. So when I went back by accident, we found out that by pruning the branches, we were getting better material. And, you know, we were getting 40-50% yield. That being said, the trees are very rare. So even though we're getting better yield, there are fewer trees. The beauty of that, though, is that you're pruning branches, you're not killing any trees, and that's sustainable. Ebony is a tree that doesn't like other ebony trees. So once you find an ebony tree, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have just found the mother lode. You may have to travel another 50 miles to find another. And you're not hopping in a car and driving to the next tree. You're you're journeying through thick jungles. And unfortunately, in Vietnam and Cambodia, there's a lot of unexploded landmines. So it gets pretty dangerous. Ebony looks like coal, and so the locals love to use it as fuel for cooking. They have this superstition that the spirits of charcoal are in the wood, and that's a gift to them to use in their cooking. And cooking with this wood brings them good flavors and good health. To prove that the food is fresh, the locals will... It's beyond flash frying. The food still moves when you're eating it. And that gets kind of dicey when you're eating squid.
Components in a bow is the shell. We have a circle of shell inlaid into each side of the frog. In this case, it's a abalone shell. Different shells are used, but I really like this stuff. And on the base of the frog, then you have what we call a slide made of shell that is dovetailed into the base of the frog. That's taken out when you go to rehair a bow. That abalone shell is referred to as mother of pearl. You can see extraordinary colour in it. It's very reflective. All sorts of stunning colours in it. It can look a bit like a beautiful West of Ireland sunset at times, actually. The abalone that I get, because I buy it in sections that have been cut out and flattened, I don't know what size of a fish it is. It's a univalve creature, so just one shell that would move around on the rocks, like a limpet, I suppose. I don't know anything about exactly where it comes from, how it's harvested, whether it's farmed, whether it's fished, I'm not sure. The paua shell is used by a lot of bow makers. Paua would be a thing maybe 150 mil long, 100 mil wide, that sort of thing, maybe 50 mil high. It's a relatively substantial fish. We haven't talked much about the metal. It's usually silver. It's quite a pure silver. And I think the combination of the varying orange, red, brown colours of the Pernambuco and the black of the ebony and the silver just complement each other really, really nicely. So I love working with silver. I use a small jeweler's lathe for some things. So there are some fairly fine colours there at the front of the silver part of the button where it meets the stick. And it's really easy to turn. What we call the ferrule, the silver part on the front of the frog. That's two pieces of silver, one piece bent into a curve and another flat piece, the two of them soldered together, finished with files, finer and finer files, and then finally sandpaper, and then finally a polishing wheel to get that sort of finish on it. But occasionally people will ask for a bow to be, as we say, gold-mounted. So everywhere you see silver here, there'll be gold on that bow instead. I go over to Paris quite often. It's nice to have an excuse to visit some of these places, you know. They're always interesting to visit. The place I buy silver and gold, there's always a bit of crack and a bit of banter. So I like going in there, you know. So rather than buy a year's worth of supply, I'll buy a certain amount. Also, of course, it's expensive. If I'm buying gold, I'll buy enough for maybe a few bowls. I'd rather do that regularly than try to come up with the sort of money required to to buy a year's worth of gold because it's an awful price, you know.
Now we're on Rue Amour. We're going to the gold shop. I think a lot of bowmakers would come here for gold. Bowmakers tend to use rose gold as opposed to yellow gold. Rose gold keeps its colour quite well. And so I've been buying gold here since I started bowmaking in 2002. And I remember on one of my early visits, walking along right where we're walking now, and catching up with the guy who was walking along in front of me, dressed very shabbily, an old beret and an old crushed, very worn suit, looking fairly down and out. And he was kind of shambling along, and I caught up with him just as we got to the door of the gold shop. And to my great surprise, he got to the door first and he rang the doorbell. So in he went and in I went. And he goes up to the counter in there and he reaches into the pockets of his jacket and he pulls a big gold bar out of each pocket and puts them up on the counter in front of him. And I'd say my jaw hit the floor. Tens and tens of thousands of euros worth of gold there, like. So here we are, SCMK.
High security.
Bonjour, monsieur Bouchet. Ça va?
Ça va.
Alors, c'est une petite commande aujourd'hui.
C'est pas grave.
Oui, c'est que...
Bowmakers who are busy have fairly long waiting lists, so I have a waiting list now of 3 years. And I'm always trying to catch up. I try to get bows delivered as on time as I possibly can. Things can run late sometimes, so the 3 years is approximate. On the other hand, there are people who simply don't want to wait, which is fair enough. I don't think I'd wait. Thankfully, most people are prepared to wait, which is great. It's a healthy period for us, I guess. You know, there's plenty of work. I, like many other bowmakers, would operate quite internationally, so it's not like we're marketing our work to one or two countries. It's spread all over the world, really. In the past, bows were considered like an accessory to the instruments. They were often given away free. If you bought a violin, you might be given a really good quality bow with it. It's thrown in for nothing or cheaply. Bows didn't command the sort of prices that they command today. So they had to be made very fast for a bowmaker to make a living. He had to work hard and fast. So I don't know how long it would have taken a bowmaker, say 200 years ago, to make a bow, but I think we can probably assume it was a matter of a few days rather than the week and a half that it might take me. They were obliged to work very fast. We have the luxury of taking a bit more time. So the work these days tends to be more precise. But the speed that they made bows at in the past produced a lot of flair as well, you know, a lot of character.
Across the street is a shop belonging to Pierre Caradeau, great violin maker and great restorer. Hugely sought after in Europe for setting up and adjusting instruments. He has a great talent in that regard. And he has a shop here that goes back a few generations.
Where Eugene Sartori's workbench is.
Salut Pierre.
Ça va?
Oui.
Merci.
This is the workbench of Sartori. He was one of the greatest French bowmakers of the 20th century. It's around more in the early 1900s. Wow. Wow, c'est incroyable, ça.
C'est lui qui l'a fait.
So we're looking at a miniature cello bow, I guess. It's about 80, 90 millimeters long in gold and tortoiseshell, and the finest tortoiseshell. It's absolutely tiny, and it's a perfect miniature of a bow made by Eugène Sartori. It even has his brand stamp along the side. That is absolutely incredible. It's the most delicate little thing you could imagine. My God. And it's perfect. Beautiful Pernambuco. Very impressive. It's so small, so delicate, you feel like just holding it, you could break it. People sometimes made miniature bowls just for the hell of it, basically.
But there's a lot of making in that, tiny as it is. You know, it's not an easy thing to do.
Here we have some bow-making planes. Sartori's planes. It's nice to see them. Very traditional style. One about 4 inches long, one about 2 inches long, one about an inch and a half long. There's a lot of history in these tools. He would have made bows for a lot of great musicians, and his bows would still be very sought after today. He's a very prolific maker, and there would be a lot of his bows in current use. Bows last a very, very, very long time. So there are bows made by François Xavier Tourte in the late 1700s that are still very much in use today. François Xavier Tourte was born towards the end of the 18th century. He apparently started life as a watchmaker. But he had an older brother who was a bowmaker, and I think his father was a bowmaker. And he went into bowmaking, and it was lucky that he did. You could say he did for the bow what Stradivari did for the violin. He standardized things like the length of the bow. He finalized design of the frog, so he added metal where there wasn't metal before. And he basically brought the bow to the fullness of its evolution, and it has not really changed since. And it was fluctuating a lot over time before he came along, but he really standardized everything. Things changed around the start of the 19th century. So a lot of the old violins, like Stradivari's violins, they were taken apart. A new neck would have been fitted at a higher angle, and then a stronger bass bar put in to withstand that extra pressure on the instrument, to be more powerful, to project more in bigger concert halls. So you end up with something that's quite different sounding, and that's what we still have today. But Stradivari would never have heard that. He died in 1737, I think. So he would have never heard his instruments sounding like we hear them. But yet, interestingly, his instruments, apart from needing that bass bar replaced, still work fantastically well. Now we're going to a shop called Au Ver à Soie, that means the silkworm, and this is where I buy silk thread to incorporate into the lapping on a bow. Bonjour, je m'appelle Gary, je voudrais acheter du soie, s'il vous plaît. It's a beautiful old shop. An ancient antique cash register, wooden shelving from floor to ceiling, old wooden counter, skeins of silk hanging all along in front of the window, bobbins of silk everywhere, in fact. There's a lot of colour here. There's a lot of wood and there's a lot of colour. So I'm just choosing some colours that I'd like to use on my bows. There's one sort of a bluey-grey that I like to put a little bit of in the lapping. So that can be quite a plain-looking thing, or you can intersperse coloured silk thread in amongst the lapping, so you have little bands of colour, just to add a little bit of interest. And I use mostly a thread that has a core of silk with a very fine silver wire wrapped around it that protects the stick from wear from the musician's fingers. That's something that gets replaced on a regular basis. Much as the hair gets replaced on a regular basis, the lapping, while lasting a lot longer, does wear. The lapping and the leather thumb grip.
My name is Nathalie. My family name is Boucher, and we are the fifth generation to manage the company, so of the same family. And we have always made silk threads for embroidery, knitting, surgery, fishing now, fly fishing. The silk is coming from China because they are the best producer of silk. So all the process is made in France, the winding, and then dyeing, and we have about 1,000 different colors. So the worm is making his cocoon. Which makes two different type of silk. And before it becomes a butterfly, you have to kill the worm inside the cocoon so that the worm is not breaking the cocoon. Because if it's broken, the silk can't be used. You boil the cocoon with the worm inside, so you kill the worm. It's awful, I know. And after, you take out the first filament of the cocoon, which makes pure silk, which is more shiny and stronger, because this is the first thread coming out of the cocoon. And then you take the rest of the cocoon and you make spun silk. Les vers à soie sont des animaux très fragiles. Ils ont besoin de beaucoup de calme.
She's talking about how sensitive these silkworms are. So they have to be reared in ideal temperature, even temperature. They don't like noise. For example, dogs barking could distress them. The quality of the leaves that they're fed has to be very high. I'm not sure what those leaves are, but...
Mûrier. Mulberry tree.
Ah, mulberry. Okay, right. So all these very particular conditions have to be observed. So it's difficult to rear silkworms.
Jesse?
So I've been coming to this leather company, TCIM, for many years. Now it's been taken over by, as I understand it, a huge international fashion company. As a result of that, we haven't been allowed to do any recording in the shop. Hence, we're standing outside talking about where we have been. And the things we saw in that shop were things like lizard, ray, ostrich skin, crocodile, alligator, python, dyed every color under the sun. These leathers have been put through all sorts of processes in terms of color and appearance and finish, and it's an absolute riot of color when you walk in there. There are alligator and crocodile skins that are black, that are brown, that are bright red, that are gold, that are pink. I bought six small lizard skins, black, glazed, maybe 10 inches wide, 14, 15 inches long. I would cut out a little piece, 25 mils wide, about 35 millimeters long. I wrapped that around the stick just in front of the frog to protect the stick from wear from the musician's thumb. They're ideal for bow making in that they're quite thin. They look great, but they're very hard wearing.
The shell that I use, I get from a supplier near Beauvais. Marie-Pierre de la Roelle is her name. She is the second generation of a family that run this business. I meet her at trade fairs. In fact, the last time I met her was at a conference in Brittany. And there was a bunch of us on an evening cruise around the Gulf de Morbihan in the south of Brittany. And we were having a seafood dinner. Crab and shellfish and bits of lobsters and a lot of stuff that involved breaking with pliers, messy stuff. And I was sitting across the table from her. Everyone was trying to keep themselves kind of clean and trying to be careful about where juices were being squirted. And Marie-Pierre didn't care. She was just tearing into stuff and chomping into fish, and there was squirts of juice going absolutely all over the place, you know. She's a great character. I haven't been to their workshop. Been threatening to for a long time. I would like to have a cigarette. Is that okay?
It's possible to smoke in the workshop.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh. You know that you shouldn't smoke.
Yes, I do. But thank you for reminding me.
You probably know that mother of pearl particle and ivory or bone particle is very dangerous.
Sure, the dust is dangerous.
It's the same as the wood. Bow makers must take care with the...
The dust.
You have to use this. Des masques et des aspirateurs, c'est très très important. Do you want to have a look to the mother of pearl? Bow makers use this kind of shell, so ormeau. So there is the big one.
They're beautiful. They're big. This one I'm holding here must be what? 10 inches long, 6 inches wide, an inch and a half to 2 inches high. Very big.
From New Zealand, this is blue shell. From Mexico, it is green shell. From Japan or from the west coast of France, this is pink shell.
The shell that comes from New Zealand, in New Zealand, they call it powa.
Powa.
Powa shell.
Powa shell.
When I lived in New Zealand, I used to dive for those shells.
Ah, okay.
I used to eat these fish a lot in New Zealand.
Yes, and it was very,
very nice.
Good.
Beautiful. Yeah.
bow makers use a green shell or pink shell. The name is Haliotis. And there is a lot of kind of Haliotis in the world. Maybe 100 or maybe 200, I don't know. There is a very, very big list. So it's difficult for us to know exactly what it comes from. It's better to buy shell from a farm. Because there is some shell that bow maker can't use. The rule begins more and more strict regarding mother of pearl as elephant ivory.
But we got permission from a gentleman that had a lot of property along the river. A friend and I flew in and floated, and we shouldn't have been there because it was in September, and it was getting late in the year, and it was probably the most far-flung place that I'd ever been. We got this very, very remote location and had to inflate our raft, and when we got there, we found out that the pump was not functioning. The plane wasn't going to be back for 10 days. Well, we took an old glove and we made a gasket and inflated it. And we were pretty downhearted, and it's starting to snow. The animals were just gathering everywhere, and you saw flocks of birds headed south. And it was beautiful in its own way. It just, not much vegetation in the area. We got the boat going and went around the corner, and we just saw a little hint of blue. I said to my friend, I says, "Is that what I think it is?" And he says, "I think so." And we let out a few hoops and hollers, pulled it out, and there was about a 100-pound mammoth tusk. The tip was broke off, but it was in very good condition. That fine, it was rather difficult because it snowed on us and we had trouble getting out of there. We actually found a Nupiat hunting camp and holed up when it snowed, and the pilot barely got us out of there before winter completely set in. But we were really fortunate to have a place because he couldn't pick us up for about a week. And then when he landed to pick us up, he got stuck in the snow, and we had to dig it out and make the runway a little longer on the gravel bar so we could get out of there. The largest I've ever had was just a little bit less than 300 pounds, one tusk, over 14 feet long. But most of it's smaller animals, and you know, I've had little tiny baby ones. The mammoth was very similar in size to an Asian elephant, and they were a grass eater, which is evidently very abrasive. And they had six sets of teeth in their lifetime, one tooth on each side, and there's four exposed at one time. And as the tooth wore out, a new one was pushed in from behind. And when the last tooth wore out, they died. They guess the life of a mammoth would be similar to an elephant, 40 to sometimes 60 years. I believe that instrument maker and myself as an artist are giving honor to that incredible animal that lived it a long time. It all kind of fits in with the overall scheme of things.
They come from the plains, you know, the deserts over there. The wild horses, of course. But somebody actually owns the wild horses.
Michael, why do we need to go to those countries for...
Well, because of the shortage of horses in this country that are slaughtered. At one time, even 40, 50 years ago, when I was a kid, there was a lot of horses around, draft horses, you know.
Sure.
And when they were slaughtered, they used to get the body hair off them and the manes and the tails. And I also got a lot from Ireland. That was really good hair.
Is that right?
And also, we used to get hair from all the slaughterhouses in England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales at one time. And that's all we used to use. With the shortage of hair now, that if a little girl's got a pony and it dies, she wants to bury it or to cremate it. And you don't get the hair from the body at all anymore. So that's really the reason why we all started to go over to China to get the hair.
I see. So yeah. It's not a question of it being a cold country and that producing better hair than a warm country. That's not true.
This can be a cold country as well. Yeah, I mean, yeah. The hair over here actually was superior to any other. It was quite thick all the way down the hair. Really good hair over here.
I see. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Every year, they sort out, like, the seven-year-olds, which, when you think about it, a seven-year-old horse has the longest tail up to about 35, 36 inches because it only grows 5.5 inches a year. So by the time it's 7 years old, that tail will be about 3'6" long. Ideal for bow hair. Out of a tail for use in a bow, you would get maybe at the most 5 hairs. All right, you might get 20 hairs out from that tail of 30 inches longer, but there might be a lot of them damaged, like Michael was showing you there. So you have to take all them out. They have to sort that out. So you finish it with about 5 from every tail. So you can imagine just how many tails you would need to make a kilo of bow hair. You'd need hundreds of horses.
Yeah.
There's lots of hair up the tail part, you know, the bulk of the tail, and then it starts to come down to nothing. So there to take out, and that's why you get your bow hair. Very expensive stuff. They round them all up every year, and then they'll slaughter more for meat. In Mongolia, they're slaughtered. And then the hair comes off from the neck and the body and the hock, which have all different uses, and then it's transported over to China. The hair is so valuable that sometimes they will get mugged and people are being killed transporting the hair over to China to be dressed. So when we play the bow sometimes, I will think about the poor Chinese guys that get killed. Hell of a trade.
Oh my God, the rate of the forest disappearing is just unreal, and it's not being allowed to grow back. A lot of people think that Pernambuco is being logged specifically for the bow trade. It's actually not. The destruction of the tree, along with the Mata Atlantica in general, is clearing the forest for cattle. My brother, being the clever man that he is, he'd start looking at the fence posts that the ranchers were using to fence in their cattle, which included Pernambuco, and they thought he was crazy at first. He would find more common trees that grew quickly around the area, pull up the old fence posts, and then replace with brand new shiny fence posts in exchange for the rare Pernambuco. He took a big gamble on that because the fence posts are very weathered, so we hope to get 1 to 2 violin bows for every stave. So it's a lot of work. However, the reward is this. They're very old fence posts, so that will produce some of the tightest, most colorful wood. And also, when the band came for a Pernambuco and other woods, he found this loophole in the law that allowed him to export the wood as salvaged wood. And that's how we started salvaging Pernambuco instead of cutting down trees. So we are refusing to take in any living material. My brother was approached one time. A man had come up with a bunch of fresh Pernambuco, and we knew that it was from a living tree. The wood was so fresh, the logs were so young. These people were desperate for money, and they took it very personal that we refused to purchase this wood. My brother was the one who really said no. The next day, his dog was poisoned as warning to never say no again. My brother to this day refuses. There's so much material that's out there that's already been cut, that's already been down for years. There's no reason why any new trees should have to be cut, period. Not for hundreds of years.
I love it. You know, that old saying, if you find something you really love doing, then you'll never really work a day in your life. I mean, I do work hard, but it's hard to imagine myself doing anything else other than this. And the thing is, I do feel that in my lifetime, I'll never get to the bottom of the whole business of bow making.
Thank you.
So it's really, really nice to have two different voices, because ultimately the bow is my lungs when I go to play. I don't sing. I'd love to say I had a beautiful voice. I'm going to do that in my next life. But this life, I sing through this piece of wood. And on its own, the piece of wood is pretty silent. So you need lungs, and the bows offer me a pair of lungs. And then if you find the right thing that matches the instrument and matches you as well, then you're free. You're free to play. You're free to fly.
If the Stick Dances was produced by Eamon Little. The bow maker was Gary Leahy. For more information on Gary's bows, see garyleahybows.com. The programme was a lyric feature commission made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland from the television licence fee. Additional sounds were provided by Chris Watson and John Bob Brennan. Additional interview recordings were engineered by Steve McLean and John Perrault. Music recorded especially for the programme was played by Catherine Hunka, the Farflung Trio and Julie Langan. Sound mixing was by Alan Kelly.
This week's lyric feature was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland from the television licence fee. The producer for Lyric FM was Owen O'Kelly.